And thanks very much, Don. Okay, good to see you, David. This is Dave Sanjek. Dave is the archivist for BMI here in New York City. He is the proud son of the late Russell Sanjek, and together they co-authored the American Popular Music Business in the 20th Century. That was Oxford University Press, 1991. Dave is quite a scholar and has authored a number of articles, and his articles have appeared in Popular Music and Society, Tracking, Arts and Entertainment Law Journal, Journal of Popular Culture, the South Atlantic Quarterly, Vassar Review, the Journal of Popular Music Studies, and American Music. He's a voting member of the Hall of Fame of the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences. I should have conferred with you. And you're a member of the Executive Council, U.S. Chapter of NARIS? Okay.
Of NARIS? No, yes, International Association for the Study of
Popular. Okay. Member of the Executive Council, U.S. Chapter of the International Association for the Society of Popular Music. Excuse me for that error. In any case, here's David Sanjek.
And thank you to Molly for inviting me to speak to you today. As is often stated in academic and other contexts, as a preface, this set of comments this morning is part of an ongoing project, which I'm in the process of putting together for Temple University Press, whose acting title at the moment, to make a bad pun, is Acting Naturally, off of the Buck Owens song, subtitle being Myth, Memory, Music, and the Movies. And what I am interested in is the fact that, to begin by quoting from several people to set a context, the late Sidney Bechet referred to music itself in his autobiography, Treat It Gentle, as a memory thing. And yet, I think it's interesting that we find ourselves in the present point of time, whether we dub the age the postmodern or otherwise, in a position where a vast amount of popular music history is in front of us, whether in the form of box sets or honorific events or celebratory organizations, that in particular in the case of popular indigenous American music, which for many years certain portions of the larger public, and admittedly to this day certain portions still, consider a demeaning and degenerate portion of American culture. At the same time, we seem to be in a position now where we are celebrating, even to the point of putting figures on stamps who a number of years ago the U.S. government would not even deign to acknowledge the existence of and would in fact chastise them after their demise for the manner in which that demise came about. So I think we find ourselves in an interesting place. At the same time, I think we find ourselves in a further interesting place in the manner in which history is presently being conducted and presently being talked about. Just was reading recently a book on New Orleans jazz, and there was an interesting comment by Kid Thomas, a member of the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, who when in the process of doing his concerts, consistently noticed the somewhat passive attitude of his audiences and commented to Alan Jaffe, the late founder of the hall and the organization, they're all eyes, look at those eyes, why don't they do something? And I think that's a nice way of referring to the manner in which, despite everything I just said, that there seems to be an interesting, distanced, and in some ways interestingly framed relationship on the part of the American public to the history of American popular music. There are pieces of it, whether they be lyrics, fragments of melody, typifying gestures caught either in photographs or on film, which are increasingly the ways in which the history of that music is being absorbed. For those of you like myself who find ourselves either periodically or consistently, myself being the former, wishing the latter, teaching American popular music in the college environment. One of the accusations on the part of certain portions of the academic and other communities is that why would you teach this stuff to people, popular culture generally? They know this already. You're merely telling them what they already know. Well, any of you who have tried to conduct such a class will discover that that statement is completely fallacious. And that the breadth of knowledge about the general indigenous culture of America is as thin in its popular vein as it is in virtually any other vein one could name. So what I'm interested in and wish to speak about this morning is the way in which that history is absorbed, is turned into narrative, and is in some instances turned into ideology in the context of film. Particularly in the case of what I'm talking about this morning will be predominantly documentary film, though if we have time to get through all the examples, the final example is a fictional film. And I think these films and the larger questions I'm looking into make reference to something that a British writer named Jeff Dyer, in a very, very wonderful book called But Beautiful, which unfortunately is unavailable in the United States, refers to as the common repertory of anecdote and information, standards, in other words, with which we refer to American popular music. And I think when we look at the documentation of this material, we find ourselves somewhat between a kind of Scylla and Charybdis, as is often the case. Either of those engage in a kind of hagiography that looks upon the music with an overly careful attention, an attention which, in the case of, I think, some people outside of that pursuit, seems myopic. On the other hand, we find people engaged in a process of examination where defensiveness seems a tactic that's almost inescapable, and begin to use language of the classic, which in its own way, I think, both raises popular culture to a height that it certainly deserves, and at the same time engages in language which may be inappropriate for the material itself. And I think we come to this question of how do we deal with both aestheticizing this music and potentially removing its significance from the immediate socio-cultural environment in which it was created. And I think this is particularly complicated when we're engaging in film and we're engaging in the visual and technological demonstration of this culture and its history to the wider public. And the manner in which when something is copied in any variety of forms, whether in the form of a film documentary, the form of a box set, the form of a reissue, the form of a celebratory event, how that relationship exists between the copy of the original that's formed there and what we do to the aura, to use the phrase of Walter Benjamin, is affected. And whether, as he asks at one point, if technological reproduction can put the copy of the original into situations which be out of reach of the original itself. So the kinds of questions I find myself asking begin with, but do not alone stay upon questions of just imperial accuracy. I'm interested in how these films construct narratives, how they decide to tell the history, either of an individual, a musical form, a region, or whatever. What kind of coherence that narrative seems to find, and how that narrative seems to incorporate diverse and possibly even competing voices within itself. This all comes back to a set of questions which I think increasingly scholars and other people who are interested in the examination of popular music find themselves asking, and one of the most prominent of which is George Lipsitz. And he says that this kind of study can answer this question of the ways in which collective memory and popular culture are peculiarly linked, how the infinitely renewable present or electronic mass media creates a crisis for collective memory, and how our collective memory decisively frames the production and reception of commercial culture. And how in the process of through memory and through study and through the presentation particularly of this history to a public who is not immediately acquainted with the music, either through their own age and distance in time, distance from culture and so forth, distance from race, distance from gender, how that history is presented for them, how memory is put together. I want to begin that examination with a short film clip from Gordon Park Sr.'s film biography of Leadbelly. It is the scene at the very end of the film, and it is a scene in which he will make us, the character, gentleman Roger Mosley playing Leadbelly, will make a statement from which I drew my title. So let me show the clip, and then I'll say a comment about it.
Judy. Time to go back.
What you gonna do with all them songs?
Well, for one thing, I'll take them to Washington, to the Library of Congress.
What for?
We collect songs.
Like there's butterflies, something?
Something like.
Then you're gonna kill them. You're gonna stick pins to them and kill them. They'll be dead for sure then. Songs got to fly free like butterflies.
Well, that's why we write them down and put them on record, so they won't be forgotten.
You got my whole damn life there. My mama, my papa, and everything that ain't gone yet. Except me saying about them. You ain't gonna stick no pins in my songs. Hide them in some Washington library. They be dead for sure then. I gotta get out of here. Save my papa alive. There won't be nothing left of him.
Professor, you through with that boy?
Just a minute.
Professor, couldn't we take his pardon song? The one he sang for the governor. We'll be in Baton Rouge next week, and it worked in Texas with Pat Neff.
No, listen, Mr. Lomax. You can take my songs at Governor O.K. Allen. But I ain't gonna stand for him in the dust like I did for that Governor Neff, Texas.
Hey, Judy, we can't promise you anything.
Well, I ain't asking. 6 months, I'll be turned loose from here. Under the hog law, I'll be free. Be my own man.
The comment that Judy Ledbetter makes to the gentleman being identified as Mr. Lomax, John Lomax, and one would have to presume the other actor would in fact be representing the still quite living and quite active Alan Lomax. And the comment being made that, you know, when you take these materials to the Library of Congress, you're just pinning butterflies to a board, raises, I think, the kinds of questions that, my study is looking into, is what happens when someone's music or the history of a certain body of music is put into a context for public consumption. Clearly, in Leadbelly's case, and certainly the comment made at the end there, that he would be free when he leaves prison, must be taken with perhaps not just a grain, but a truckload of salt, considering the kind of study that's being done now as to how his career was not merely managed, but in its own sense, to play with the term, composed by the Lomaxes themselves. What I'd like to do is proceed through several other examples and look at some of the ways in which films conduct this pinning and this composition of memory. And the first I'd like to look at is a film called Mississippi Blues. It was co-directed by the Frenchman Bertrand Tavernier, known to many of you for Around Midnight, and co-directed with a less well-known but very interesting American film director, Robert Parrish. It was shot in the Delta of Mississippi in a process which was aided by William Ferris of the Center for the Study of Southern Culture. And two kind of enterprises entered into the production of this film, one of which was on the part of Tavernier, a fascination with Southern society and Southern imagery, particularly as mediated through film. At a certain point in the film, he indicates that really all he knows about the South is one or two Faulkner novels and the film version of Intruder in the Dust and To Kill a Mockingbird. That's the South. And in the case of Parrish, the South was the place of his birth. And what I think is interesting in the film, if you have a chance at some point, all these films are on tape, to see, is the collision of two opposing and ultimately non-complementary directions in the film, one of which is Parrish's attempt to engage in a thoughtful form of nostalgia about his own childhood in the South, and the other is Tavernier's pretty much wide-eyed romanticism about Southern life, and particularly Southern music. What's interesting about the film is, despite the collision of these two projects and their really incompatibility in the course of the film, the music that is played, and that, despite the fact, which interestingly and disturbingly, often the producers, the individual musicians, are unnamed in the film, which gives the effect of having this sort of mass of performing non-white people. I mean, it's extremely disturbing at times to have, in fact, virtually every member of the French film crew given a name and a number of the people performing music in the film given none whatsoever. And I think what the film combats and attempts to resolve, and ultimately unsuccessfully, is the kind of romanticism that many people who've studied and been fascinated by Delta blues confront. Peter Guralnick, in his short book on Robert Johnson, talks rather pointedly about this problem, and he refers to the difficulty of moving around this kind of romanticism, and he refers to it as that issue of the personification of the existential blues singer, unencumbered by corporeality or history, a fiercely incandescent spirit who had escaped the bonds of tradition by sheer thrust of genius. And a number of the terms in those quotes are issues which I think these films keep coming back to, and in many cases unsuccessfully working through. Very loaded terms like genius, originality, and the sui generis nature of creation. In particular, this occurs in a moment in this film when Tavernier is bought by Bill Ferris to Dockery Farm. Dockery Farm is the plantation where a number of the most famous Delta blues musicians lived and created, specifically Charlie Patton and Tommy Johnson. And a number of younger individuals grew up in the same area and were significantly influenced by and in fact knew these individuals. Those include Roebuck Staples, the paterfamilias of the Staple Singers, and Chester Burnett, known to most of you as Howlin' Wolf. In the sequence I'm going to show you, Ferris is walking about the plantation with Tavernier, who's never been here before, and clearly has very little sense of either what the place is or what in fact occurred here. And what I find interesting about the sequence is the attempt by film, which I think is an incompatible medium to try to do this, to find a place, in this case, a place, a specific geographic locale, where a significant body of vernacular Southern music had its birth, and try through the medium of photography to distill from that place some essence, some inalienable quality in the very soil which gave rise to this music. And unfortunately, I think that that aura that film tries to give rise to is something which the medium is incapable of discovering. And in fact, perhaps even the attempt to do such or to believe that you could extract from the place some kind of essence of that sort is probably a fruitless, if not ill-conceived enterprise. It's a sequence which is in part also kind of amusing because it's one of the few times in the film, Tavernier speaks perfectly good English, where he and Ferris are conversing in French. And so this is in fact subtitled. But I think you find in sort of the comic moment of this film an attempt on Ferris's part to draw out to someone for whom this tradition is a romantic image, one of those standards to which Jeff Dyer refers, and to try to conjure through film something of what this place is. And finally, in the end, all it might be for us is a muddy pond, as you'll see in a moment. So we show that clip.
À Dockery Farms, il y a 30 ans, il y avait un groupe de musiciens de blues qui était très très important. Il y avait un chanteur qui s'appelle Charlie Patton, qui était le centre de la groupe. Et il avait le style classique du Delta, c'est-à-dire avec le bottleneck, le voix très très fort et guttural. Et après lui, il y avait une ligne de musiciennes comme Muddy Waters, John Lee Hooker et autres qui sont évolués le blues.
Et qui ont vécu, qui ont passé par Dockery Farms?
Oui, Patton a vécu à Dockery Farms. Il a chanté Down on Dockery's Farm.
Et ils étaient payés par le patron, par le propriétaire de la plantation pour venir chanter pour les ouvriers?
Oui, ce sont, c'était souvent chanté pour les Blancs. Et c'était souvent une écharpe de la travail. Les chanteurs n'ont pas souvent travaillé dans les champs. Ils ont gagné leur vie comme musiciennes, pas comme ouvriers manuels.
On est en train de marcher dans du kudzu.
Oui, c'est du kudzu. C'est un peu un symbole du sud.
Oui. C'est une plante qui envahit tout.
Oui, ça pousse 1 mètre par jour en été.
1 mètre par jour en été.
Oui.
Et alors, ces plantations, elles disparaissent ou...
Oui. Ce qu'on voit, c'est la fin d'une époque de paternalisme et de relations entre les Noirs et les Blancs. Et les gens qui achètent la terre ne vivent pas au Mississippi. Il y a une plantation qui est à la reine d'Angleterre. Il y a les Allemands, les Arabes qui viennent pour prendre la terre. Et les cultivateurs blancs du Mississippi, de plus en plus, ne seront pas là. Et ça change la musique qui était un peu une réflexion de ce système va changer aussi.
Could you give us a line or two, that piece that you wrote yourself?
Which one?
I think in effect we find ourselves at the end of that clip as much perhaps lost in the kudzu as the camera is. That there is an effort here in that panning shot over the landscape to, through the medium of film, to draw out something of what is an ineluctable essence of this landscape that gave rise to these people. And yet every time I watch that clip, one thing that always strikes me is the worker in the background. That at one point, you know, after all these comments, you know, oh, well, it's the paternalistic system that's long gone and there's these foreign landlords. Here's this one lone black man working behind him. And you almost like feel like turning around and saying, could you ask him maybe what song he sings and what is his relationship, you know, through music or through whatever form of culture he finds to make sense of this still working plantation? So in this case, the collision between nostalgia and the attempt to document a place occurs. Another kind of element I find often occurring in these films, particularly in films which attempt to celebrate individuals, is a misguided notion of authorship. Certainly one of the more contested words, if not notions, in contemporary culture. And I find that in the film I'm about to show you, which is Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, the celebratory documentary for Chuck Berry's 60th birthday, there is a fascinating episode in this film where not only an outside individual to the tradition from which Chuck Berry emerged, but one who himself was influenced by and succeeded financially and otherwise far more from that tradition, not only attempts to categorize Chuck Berry's music, but in effect tell him how he should play it. That individual is Keith Richards, the lead guitar player of the Rolling Stones. For those of you who are unaware of certain elements of Chuck Berry's career, one of the salient ones to this film is the fact that, so Chuck Berry reports in his autobiography, he, for a number of years to this day, does not perform with a traveling backup band. He habitually comes into town, demands cash on the barrel, goes in, starts playing, tells the people the chords to go, and if they don't know what the hell he's doing, they better figure it out pretty damn quickly. In the film, at one point, Bruce Springsteen tells about his time playing behind Chuck Berry, and this is exactly what happened. Chuck Berry says in his autobiography he did this because of just a difficulty with working with other musicians. I think one could, with a greater amount of time, explain other potential reasons for that behavior. The other important factor in his autobiography is, and I found this repeated a number of months ago when Chuck Berry was interviewed by the eminent musicologist Brian Gumbel on the Today Show, that any attempt on anyone's part to induce language of original creation to Chuck Berry is met with utter rejection. Chuck Berry sees himself as part of a musical tradition. If you ask him how Maybelline was written, he will tell you the song from which it was taken, the rhythmic pattern from which he drew it. He does not see himself as an original creator in which, in Western culture, we tend to use that word. What happens in this film is that that is, in fact, the language of authorship with which Keith Richards is familiar and the one with which he wishes to categorize Chuck Berry. One of the other accusations, which has some factual validity, which has long been held about Chuck Berry, is his inability to play in tune, that he basically gets on stage and does what the hell he wants, takes the money, and runs. And Keith Richards said if for no other reason he wanted to have this 60th birthday so that for once in his life, so he says, he could hear Chuck Berry play in tune. James Clifford, who is an anthropologist and one of the more interesting studiers of the predicament of culture and the predicament of the collision of cultures, as is the case here, has something very interesting to say of that most loaded of nouns, authenticity. If authenticity is relational, there can be no essence except as a political, cultural invention, a local tactic. And what I will suggest to you is occurring in this film and in the sequence I'll show you in a moment is not merely a collision of tactics, but a collision of sensibilities. Chuck Berry is viewed by the individuals, including Keith Richards and Eric Clapton, who speak of him in the film, as an original creator. Somebody, in fact, they feel, who doesn't really, in fact, want to accept how original he is. They not merely want to make that claim for him, but they damn well want him to accept it, whether he likes it or not. At one point in the film, Richard says of him, I don't know if Chuck realizes what it is. Michelangelo probably thought he was third rate, too. And later, Clapton says about him, it seems like there's not an understanding on his part that he's a great songwriter, just kind of sloughs it off. Any of you have ever either read Chuck Berry's autobiography or heard the man speak, to have someone accused him of being devoid of ego is like someone accusing Richard Nixon of being devoid of a feeling that there were enemies in this world. Chuck Berry had ego enough for this room. So I find it interesting that these individuals not only wish Chuck Berry to hold true to a notion of his career and his form of music that they postulate, not that he believes, but also that it seems to indicate a profound misunderstanding of the very nature of African American music itself and the manner in which to use the triad of words which Albert Murray in his study of jazz refers to, the fact that African American music proceeds by extension, elaboration, and refinement, not by a notion of sui generis individuality that seems to be more of a Western notion. This same attitude, in fact, is held by the director of the film, Taylor Hackford. And I found some quotes from him in an interview which were quite interesting that, again, to him, he has this notion of, at one point he refers to them in sort of astronomical terms, that great musicians are sort of like comets. They just suddenly appear out of nowhere, as if musicians were unconnected with or have no functional relationship to either their predecessors, their culture, their region, their race, their gender, etc. And at one point in that interview, Hackford says, to me, the fascinating thing was to make a portrait of an artist who truly doesn't recognize what his contribution has been. He thinks he was lucky. That's the last damn thing Chuck Berry thinks he was. He thinks he just knocked off a couple of ditties and happened to hit at the right time, and then the Beatles and the Rolling Stones picked it up and made him more famous, and he's been fooling everybody all along. He just won't accept the fact that he was a wonderful songwriter who created an art form, and that's interesting to me. I think Chuck Berry fully believes he's an interesting songwriter, would probably reject the notion that he created an art form, but certainly believes he exists in a larger culture. In the clip you're about to see, an interesting moment occurs. It begins with an argument over an amplifier setting. And yet, what I think is really central to the argument is something more substantial. It is not merely the fact that a younger, white, wealthy musician has elected it upon himself to celebrate one of his idols, a charitable and surely thankful enterprise, but that also he is attempting to form not just a narrative of this man's work, but a notion of what it's about that doesn't seem to have too much relationship to the individual himself. Secondly, and more importantly, in fact, is where the concert occurs and the city in which it's set. It is Chuck Berry's hometown of St. Louis, with which, having lived there for 10 years, I am somewhat acquainted, and which, like most large cities in the United States, is fraught with racism. And in fact, as Chuck Berry explains later in the film, without Keith Richards' presence, the theater in which the concert was held was the Fox Theater. For those of you who know St. Louis, it is, in effect, sort of the Radio City Music Hall of St. Louis. It is the top venue in town. At one point in earlier years, it was, in fact, a film theater, as was more routinely the Radio City Music Hall. And as a young boy, Chuck Berry went there with his father to see the Ronald Coleman version of A Tale of Two Cities. You should also know that several blocks away from the Fox Theater is the courthouse, the central court of the city of St. Louis. It's a rather impressive building with a long set of marble steps leading up to it, on which steps in years past was where the slave market in St. Louis was held, that portion of the city being quite close to the Mississippi River. These are all facts with which Chuck Berry is intimately acquainted, and is intimately acquainted with the hostility he was shown not only as a child, but certainly at the moment when he last was at this theater. So he says at one point, what inspires me to play here is what it represents, i.e. the theater, not what it, i.e. the concert, is. So what it seems to me is going on in this argument over an amplifier setting is this, that the sour notes, the inadequately programmed amplifier, Berry's haughty disdain for the kind of details that presumably ought to concern a musical professional, all these must pale in Chuck Berry's mind before the fact that this time the doors of the Fox Theater open wide for him. His name, not Ronald Coleman, appears on the marquee. At the risk of cheap irony in the light of the source material of the film from which he was excluded as a child, is not the performance itself, the whole trajectory of Berry's career, a far, far better thing than any well-tuned guitar or properly set amplifier? If the blues played by the musicians in the Mississippi Delta enabled the enactment, as Albert Murray believes, of, quote, rituals of resilience and perseverance through improvisation in the face of capricious disjuncture, then the music played by Chuck Berry on the stage of the Fox Theater in 1987 must be seen as one more act of reaffirmation in the face of adversity. As we're about to see, not only is that the case, but this gentleman, Mr. Richards, who has deigned to decide how this concert will be conducted, is now, following the argument over the amplifier setting, going to be, in fact, taught by Chuck Berry how to be Chuck Berry. And he doesn't get it.
These are amps as I said it. That's my amp, and I'm setting it the way I wish it.
Well,
I'm not speaking to you.
I'm
answering your question. I'm not
interested in how it sounds. That's going to sound on the film, baby.
I'm interested in how it sounds here. Well, sounds the way I wish it to sound. And the way it's going to sound if I am playing.
None.
I am not playing.
Hey, you turn it away from me.
Why don't you check the tape out?
Why?
It was being done.
Yeah. Well, don't touch my amp.
He said
it won't be done.
He already said he didn't.
Well, he said why it's being done.
Why it's being done is because it's not recording well.
Okay.
And that's what's going to end up on the film.
That's
why they're doing it, because that's why it's going to end up on the film.
If it winds up on the film, that's the way Chuck Berry plays it. You understand?
I understand.
Okay.
Well, I understand.
Well, I was talking to anybody.
But you've got to live with it afterwards. They're trying to.
I've been living for 60 years with it.
I know that.
Okay, well, then realize it.
But is it going to be after all dead and gone? Right? It ain't you and me, you know. It's
well,
everybody.
I ain't dying. No, they ain't dying. Huh? Go on in and see your song.
Shit. I think he's got a little worm in him, yeah? He's the only guy that's hit me that I never got back, you know. Maybe I'm saving it. But,
tell me about that.
I was in a dressing room like this. He'd done a show in New York. And I went up to say hello, and he was just leaving with a little bit of white tail. And I made the mistake of tapping him on the shoulder and saying, "Hey, Chuck, don't rush off without saying hello," because I've known him often. I met him in 65 first time. Yeah, and he just turned around and he just gave me a full shot right in the face. And wow, I was very proud of the fact that I didn't go down. I don't know, maybe he got his fingers burnt earlier on and decided to shut the rest of the world out. I think since he got out of jail on that rap, he came out with a chip on his shoulder, and I just tried to knock it off. Yeah, I don't know whether I did or not, but I respect the man. Always will, yeah, for what he's done. And also for myself, you know, I've lived under the umbrella of the Rolling Stones for 20-odd years. In a way, it almost totally insulated a scene as maybe Chuck. This must be one of the most difficult gigs. Dan, if I can handle this, I ain't worried about nothing else.
if you sing it, and they just play the rhythm, and I'll put the fills in and in between those vocal lines.
Say that again.
If you sing it and you just play the rhythm, then I don't have to keep hopping and trying to cover both ends. I need the rhythm guitar at least,
okay.
You know, because it would be too much probably for the sing and play the lead fills as well, right?
Well, it was.
Well, I don't play the rhythm. You want to do the fills? It's only on those two verses. I mean, you know, the grooving. Fly me in a my machine.
Yeah, but
you can groove on now.
But you know, the stops line. And starts is what we were looking for.
Yeah. You know. Well, we got them. Yeah, as long as we have the.
And you're gonna play the solo, right?
If he wants me to, you know.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, we need that.
I need that guitar.
If time allowed, you could see the about four more starts before Keith Richards can, in fact, be Chuck Berry. So Chuck's got a little worm in him, huh? That seems to me to be only a comment that someone can make who is unacquainted with or allows himself to be unaware of the history not only of Chuck Berry's relationship to the corporate structure of American popular music, but also is in a position financially and otherwise to have profited from it, and in fact not have to worry about the kinds of things Chuck worried about. Secondly, it is interesting to see that in fact a music that seems so simple is in fact needs to be taught. As Muddy Waters once said, everybody thinks they can play this stuff, but then they try, and they can't. I want to end with one last clip, which with time being as it is, I want to introduce rather quickly. One of the central metaphors and realities of American popular music and rock and roll particularly is the road and all that is incumbent upon the road. The road is a place of travel. The road is a place of performance. The road is a place of escape. The road is a place of sexual adventure. The road is a place where, should one meet perhaps at crossroads, one finds out how to perform. The road is a metaphor, I think, increasingly has become vacuous and empty of meaning. And a number of films have begun to question what, in fact, meaning that metaphor might have at this point in time. And this will be the fifth film. And this is from a film directed, co-directed by Robert Frank. For those of you who know the Beat Generation and photographic history, Robert Frank is the creator of the classic and rather influential book of photographs, The Americans. He also has an interesting relationship to the Rolling Stones in that the photographs on the cover of Exile on Main Street are in fact from that book. And Frank, as I'm studying in a further paper, Frank is the director of a documentary on the Stones 72 tour called Cocksucker Blues, which for a variety of reasons the Stones refused to allow shown publicly. In this film, a young erstwhile musician named Julius takes off on a quest literally to the end of the road. As you'll see in this clip, you are literally at the ocean's edge. And in fact, geographically, the film moves through the North American continent into Canada and into the edge of the Canadian continent. And in this clip, he has finally found the object of his quest, who is a man named Elmore Silk, who is a great designer and builder of guitars. Elmore has just sold all of his existing stock of guitars to a Japanese business concern with the promise that any of the rest of them that he has will be destroyed. This is what Julius comes upon. And I end perhaps with an apocalyptic moment, but in fact a moment that questions whether the metaphors and the myths behind our stories of American popular indigenous music not only need re-examination, but in fact may need redefinition. So we end at the end of the road with Elmore, Julius, and a bonfire.
The room was empty. Through the window, I could see Elmore burning the guitars. Like a jerk, I ran out anyway.
What are you doing?
Leaving out?
Why are you burning the guitars? There's no way to make a deal with you, right? Is that it?
I told him to go fuck himself and fuck his guitars.
You want a guitar?
But he kept on burning them.
Go on.
I stood there playing one of Elmore's weird guitars as the sky grew lighter and the whole deal went up in flames. It was really cold that morning. I don't know. I guess it always seems colder when you're leaving someplace.
So we find ourselves at the end back on the road in quest of what meaning music might have for us. And at this point in our history, whether the means with which we've defined it, turned it into stories, and turned it into myths might need reconsideration. I do not mean to imply by this the more fashionable language of popular music being dead, but as the late Frank Zappa once said in a reference to jazz in particular, it may not be dead, it just smells funny. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Let's have a question or two. Yes.
I'm glad you came to the notion of myth at the end, and I think maybe that's perhaps central to your problem, to the dilemma as you outline it, is that, you know, that myth is created collectively, and that really there are no such things as correct myths either. You know, we can see through them, but we have need of the myth anyway, and maybe even if the myths have little to do with historical or sociological accuracy, they serve the purpose that Myth has always served, to make us feel more at home with who we are, and to reduce history to the terms that we can understand it, accept it, deal with it, and even enjoy it. I mean, I think you probably found some of the most embarrassing moments in recent documentary films.
I'll take one.
Because it's good to have them come together, because it shows how strong those clashes are. But there's a certain inevitability to everything that we saw.
But I think what's both interesting, troublesome, and yet must be dealt with is the fact that this is how we are now being given the history of this material, predominantly.
Film in other places.
I would venture as a different example, which in another portion of this work I go into. If you, for example, like many other people, and I don't mean to be as snotty as I make this comment to sound, had purchased the great coffee table record of the 90s, the Robert Johnson recordings, and in fact read Steve LeVere's notes in there, you would have one of the most misguided, fraudulent, and I would just say flat out stupid notions of what that music is about I can imagine. And yet for those people who in fact not only played those recordings, which I hazard to think are probably not that large in number, it was seen as cultural cachet, I think, to possess that recording for many people. But who in fact read the notes, they are given, and consider the likelihood how many people would proceed further from there. What is given in that document, or say a young person seeing this film on Chuck Berry alone. So in a sense, I'm not merely concerned with imperial accuracy or even myth construction in the sense that I think there's somewhere behind the curtain, the real wizard is there and we'll know how Oz is constructed. It's not that, but I'm interested to see how the stories are being constructed with which people are being presented as either fact or how history should be related to them in the present day.
Well, thank you. It was a brilliant talk.
One more quick question, Don.
So it seems to me the real issue is who controls the making and dissemination of these myths.
Yes. 3D technology through which one can reconstruct that history, either reorder the recordings, take out what one considers unimportant to that history. But in fact, in a context where record companies realizing that it's not only cheaper to produce, but also a broader means of accumulation of capital to sell history. We're in a process right now where the selling of musical history is at perhaps one of its great heights. How is that history then being consumed and reconstructed, which is a process we must always remember? I utterly reject the notion that we passively sit there and suck this in as if it were gospel, but how we then reconstruct the dynamics and the elements which are given to us.
Yeah. Good question.